Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you with us on this Friday. 5 years ago, northern Minnesota and Wisconsin experienced one of the worst floods in recorded history. The June 2012 flood dumped up to 10 inches of rain over 2 days. It caused more than $100 million in damage in northeastern Minnesota, washing out roads and submerging basements across the Twin Ports. Hundreds of homes suffered significant damage in Minnesota and Wisconsin. Douglas County Emergency Management Director Keith Kessler sat down this week to reflect on the flood and what's changed since then.
Well, I can remember the evening that the storm hit. I had been working late. I'd went out to get a bite to eat, come back to the office. And I'm thinking it was probably about 8 o'clock in the evening. It's like the sky just opened up and dumped on us. Things started falling apart. I can remember it. I stayed in the office till about 1:30 in the morning. And when I drove down Belknap, I would make it. It was similar to driving a speedboat across Lake Superior. I was driving 10 miles an hour. The water was so deep on Belknap that I could hardly see through the splashing of the water off the tires. I remember when I walked out of the office, the water in our parking lot was probably 3 and 4 inches deep. It was coming down so hard. I went home, thought I was going to get a few hours sleep, and about 3 o'clock I got up and turned around and come back to work.
The question remains, how much damage was done? Douglas County Emergency Management's Dave Sletten says that'll take a while to figure out countywide.
Many of the areas are unable to be assessed at this time as they are still water topped. They, you know, maybe some infrastructure damage.
Both Superior and Douglas County hope to get federal and state help.
And started getting the damage reports that we were getting. We were seeing the damage that we had in the city. And I know that next morning, I'm thinking it was in that 6 to 7 o'clock range, we met with the mayor, the county board chair, county administrator, City Public Works. We had the whole group of the key players, the decision makers at the table, and trying to get together a briefing from what had happened here in the city as far as the public works infrastructure problems. We were trying to piece in, did we have problems out in the county, and making a game plan. The hardest part that morning was many people at the table figured that we were going to be able to get help for the individual homeowners. And I had the ugly task of telling them that was probably not going to happen, that there would not be a pot of money, that everybody would get everything taken care of by the federal government.
County Board Chairman Doug Finn says right now they feel isolated.
To be honest, we're not overly optimistic how much money is going to be available.
Besides damaged roads, homes, and businesses in Superior, 10 villages also are reporting flood damage.
You know, at the end of the day, we were fortunate local organizations stepped forth, and there was some donated money and things like that that were administered so that in some of the very worst case scenarios for people that just didn't have anything, we could get some help to get their furnaces fixed or replaced, get their water heaters replaced, things like that. But there, where basements were flooded and stuff, there was little to no help for them. And in fact, at that time, FEMA did not even consider damage to basements is being part of it. The only way you could get any money to do any repairs in a basement were it had to be living space with an occupied bedroom. Otherwise, they didn't look at any damage below the first floor.
Well, obviously, a lot of people had some flooded basements in the city.
Yeah, there were probably hundreds of them with water damage in the basements.
At the steam plant, Building and Grounds Superintendent Dusty Johnson says at one point the water reached the top of the stairs, flooding both the full basement and the sub-basement. That's where the bottom of two boilers, the water treatment, and coal equipment was kept. Johnson says most of the pumps are being rebuilt and all motors are being replaced.
For the amount of time that it's been since the flood, we've gotten an enormous amount done.
FEMA's Hannah Vick says they split into teams and started their assessments and most likely won't finish in northern Wisconsin for a few more days. Vick says they will stay until they have seen all the damage.
We may finish up later this week, although if there's additional damage that the state or the locals want to show us, we'll certainly stay as long as they need us to.
So what was the extent of the damaged roads and things like that? What did we see and how long did it take to recover from that?
Well, the public damage came in at about $3 million. And, you know, it included roads, it included problems at the wastewater treatment plant. It was just a broad brush of things that around the city. But just infrastructure was affected significantly.
What has changed since then as far as how you prepare for or respond to storms now? I mean, we're seeing heavier, more intense rainfall. And I know every time spring and summer rolls around, you're probably a little bit worried.
Yeah, we start holding our breath. It's like, you know, it's a blizzard, it's a flood, or it's a forest fire for us, it seems like. And actually, it's very difficult to prepare for flooding. You can put out the warnings, make sure people are aware. We've done things to encourage people to get things up off the floors of their basements. Don't, you know, get your furnace a foot or two off the floor on concrete blocks. Get that critical infrastructure in your home up a little higher. But as far as stopping the flooding, there's not a lot we can do. I believe the city, and you'd need to talk with someone from the city, but I believe they're doing things, and Belknap Street would be an example of where they're working on separation of sanitary sewer and stormwater sewer that will help and aid in preventing future problems. Many of the homes that were affected were actually affected by groundwater seepage into the home, and some were affected by sewer backups. So, it's just ongoing education, but there's really not a lot that we can do to stop it. People have to work on their own properties to try to minimize future damage.
Do you feel like when you were going through all of that, that you had all the resources you needed and that the response worked really well?
I think the cooperation between the city and the county was excellent. As I think back, we worked with the county highway department, brought trucks into town. The city helped with equipment and loaders. We had people from the Gordon Correctional Camp that came in to provide physical labor to load debris. So it was a city, county, state effort to help homeowners that, we couldn't give them money, but we could help them get rid of debris and things like that. And the coordination and the teamwork between the city and the county officials, I think, was excellent.
Is there anything more, though, that you feel could be done to improve response at the city, state, or federal level?
As far as response, it's very difficult to improve response on a flood. It's a situation where you have to warn people, tell them to get out of the way, and be prepared in advance. I mean, there's not much we can do about water when it comes down. The dollars and cents of it are the most difficult part, and it would be my expectation that in the future that may even be more difficult to get as budgets tighten up. You know, we have not only FEMA to look at, but we also have the Wisconsin Disaster Fund that we can use for local infrastructure issues. And over the past few years, we've collected $250,000 to help townships throughout the county. There's if they have a flooding situation that exceeds $3.56 per capita in their community, they can request us to file a paperwork for them to get some reimbursement for their repairs for flood damage and things like that.
At $160,000, the Lakeside Township in Douglas County had the most damage of any of the rural communities outside of Superior. Township Chairman Tom Johnson got the good news late yesterday evening.
I cannot tell you. The news from the president it's probably about the best news we've heard. I mean, it's going to help us out, help everybody out.
The declaration covers uninsured public infrastructure damage in Ashland, Bayfield, and Douglas counties. Douglas County Emergency Management Director Keith Kessler says the once-in-a-century flood overwhelmed the budgets of small towns.
This is super. The townships were going to be really hurting big. Talking to some of these folks, it was going to have a negative effect on a lot of things that the communities wanted to do. It was going to affect their fire departments. You know, money's got to come from somewhere, and this is going to help.
One of the spinoffs is when we have a federal presidential disaster declaration, there is a portion of the money that is earmarked for mitigation programs. And the city and some of the townships have applied for those mitigation programs to fix things and help alleviate future problems. by putting in bigger culverts, working on sewer issues and things like that. Maybe there's places where they had a culvert that repeatedly washed out. They can either put in a bigger pipe, or in some cases they actually build a bridge so that we don't have repetitive flood damage in the same spot.
Do you feel like that happened, that there were a lot of improvements that were made to the infrastructure to make it bigger to withstand more rain or these kind of flood events?
Well, this has been going on for a long time, and if I look back prior to 2012 to some of the floods that we had around 2000, I know out in the county we could go to places that roads were washed out back then, and then in the later floods, because the way culverts were increased in size or because of the way they put rock and made spillways where the water would actually run over the road instead of washing out a culvert, many places have stayed intact that had been previously destroyed.
Is there anything else that people can do, whether it's cities or local governments or just individuals, to make themselves more resilient to the kind of floods that we saw?
Well, there's good practices that you can do as a homeowner. To try to get the water to run away from your home. If you have gutters and things like that, you want to get it so that roof, the water that's coming off your roof through your rain gutters and the downspouts, runs away. If you have window wells in your basements and things, you should probably cover them so the water can't run into those window wells and into your basement. If you routinely see several inches of water in your basement, put your high-cost items like your water heater, your furnace, and that type of thing up on some concrete blocks or some kind of a stand so they're up off the floor so they don't get damaged. Having water in the basement is not a good thing, but you can minimize the expense. You're still going to have the cleanup issues, but you can minimize the expense of the hardware that you have to replace. You know, electrical outlets shouldn't be right down at the floor level. They should be up a ways on the walls and things like that.
Well, is there anything else that you'd like to add about the 2012 flood and how far we've come since then?
I guess I wish I knew a way to spread 4 inches of rain out over a week instead of several hours, but unfortunately we can't do that. When the water comes down, we just need to be prepared to respond to the devastation it creates.
Again, you've been listening to Douglas County Emergency Management Director Keith Kessler. Tuesday is the 5-year anniversary of the flood. We're going to take a short break for these announcements, but when we come back, we'll hear about a UW-Superior researcher's efforts to pinpoint how microplastics are making their way into Lake Superior and where they're going. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Lorena Rios Mendoza is an associate professor of chemistry and natural science at UW-Superior. Her findings about microbeads in the Great Lakes played a key role in a push by lawmakers to ban the manufacture of microbeads 2 years ago. Since then, Rios Mendoza has been expanding her research in Lake Superior to include sampling around wastewater treatment plants. She collected data in and around these facilities last summer.
Found in the effluent in the water and wastewater treatment plant was a lot, tons of fibers, microfibers. Some of them are plastic, but other are cotton, natural fiber, you know. But I cannot say it that most of the fibers are cotton. Still, when we did some identification, and maybe like a 60% were cotton and 40%, I can say, were polyester, mainly polyethylene and polypropylene and other kind of the plastic, the synthetic plastic fibers. But, you know, we have in the samples, we have like tangled a bunch of fibers. And then, number one, we cannot count it. But we try to count it in the two harbors, wastewater treatment plant. And then we just counted the fiber that we found separate, and we found there more than 1,000 in 60 liters, but a bunch, a lot of tangled, you know? And then I really don't know how many fibers, but I'm sure it's more. And then if we do just a simple math, what is the amount of the effluent water that they put it in the lake, we can say that we have more than 6 million of fibers every day.
Just from the two harbors, wastewater?
Just from the two harbors, yes. And then that I'm saying, we try to analyze. We did like in 96 fibers. That is a lot of fibers. But still, you know, it's, we found more cotton. We did the identification more the cotton. But it's kind of logical because the clothes, we have a mix of the between cotton and polyester. And we find a lot of polyester. And then I really don't know.
So you think it's getting in there then from people just like doing their laundry?
Yes, it's mainly. Mainly is the laundry. Because the sizes, you know, and the type. In the ocean, we can find fibers, but it's bigger and thicker. And here in the wastewater treatment plant, it's really tiny, tiny. You know, it's long, but it's not really, okay, long. We don't see it by naked eye, you know, we need a microscope. But it's so thin. This is the problem.
So what kind of problem does that pose? I mean, if, as you're looking at microplastics and thinking about, you know, things like microbeads and these fibers then that you're finding, how big an issue is that compared to what else you're finding?
You know, we found it, one microbead. And then again, if we do the simple math, will be 1,000 of microbeads by day, you know, and very small town. Because it's like 3,000 people, something like that, a little more. But and then what is the problem with the fibers?
Rios Mendoza says she's opened more than 2,000 stomachs of fish in and around Lake Superior. She says their contents contain these microscopic tangles of synthetic fibers.
Now we know why. Because the wastewater treatment plants, I put the fibers in the water. And why? Because the wastewater treatment plant, they don't have any process to retain this kind of fibers. And it depends what is the treatment that they have. Maybe they can retain like 80-90% of the fibers during the process.
So what does that mean then? You know, I mean, first off, do you have results from other wastewater treatment plants besides
Yes, we did the effluent water in the two harbors and here in Superior, that is in process already, we did it. Bayfield, Ashland, and Washburn. We did inside and outside. And we have the result. And as again, we found that mainly of fibers. And in the other plants, we found more synthetic than cotton. And outside to the wastewater treatment plant here in Duluth, we found that tons of micro beads. The fragments and a lot of fibers again.
So with the ones in Bayfield, Ashland, and Washburn, you said you've found more synthetic fibers?
Oh, more synthetic fibers, yes. But I don't, I have just the analysis, but I'm not doing yet what is the math, you know, based in what is the water, the effluent water that they have every day. I just did in two harbors. But yes, will be, again, 1,000 of fibers, synthetic fibers.
Again, from people washing their clothes and getting...
I think this is the main source from the people, yes. Because when they washing, you know, we have fibers. But when we dry it, the clothes, we have fibers production too. And everything is fine.
So why is it so important then for you to look at this and get information about what's out there?
The main situation with the microplastic is that a smaller the size, they can absorb more toxic compounds that they can find in the water, in the system, you know? And then, I don't know, if we can say that we have the one pesticide, yes, or one this new emerging contaminant from the pharmaceutical drugs or something can be attached. I'm studying just the PCBs, the organochloramine pesticides, polyaromatic hydrocarbon that is from the incomplete combustion from gasoline. All these compounds attach to the plastic. And then the smaller the size of the plastic can concentrate more. Now, I really don't know what is the concentration of the microfibers. Why? Because there is a lot in number, but in mass is too low that the instrument that we have, we can really not detect anything, you know, because the concentration in the mass is too low. It's in nanograms.
But the smaller they are, the more toxic compounds they're holding. Yes. Mm-hmm. But you're saying that there's more of these then?
Yes, there is a lot.
Rios Mendoza says she can't tell the type or the concentration of these toxic compounds in the microfibers because they're too light to be measured with the equipment she uses at her lab.
They need to have a huge concentration, and then I can see something in the instrument that we have.
So are you concerned about that at all, that you can't measure it?
Yes, I am. And then maybe, you know, because this was just 60 liters. And then maybe if I can collect like a 24 hours, more volume, more fibers, and then I can have a more mass.
How are you going to use all of this information, or what's the next step in your research?
Okay, that I did with the last summer was collected inside and outside of to the wastewater treatment plant, and my idea was to prove that this is the source. It's one source of these microplastic particles to the lake. Now, this summer that we are collecting samples again, but I'm doing in the tributaries to the Lake Superior, the rivers, the creek, to see if there is another source of the plastic. And then, now that I want to have is the picture, what is the source, what is coming from all the microplastic that can go to the lake. If the plastic is coming from the wastewater treatment plant, what is the fate? What is going river up to the lake, it's moving, or maybe it can be attached with another bacteria or another microorganisms, and maybe can sink. And then we don't know what is the concentration in the sediment, for example. And we don't know what is the concentration in the middle of the water column. And then we really don't know the microplastic coming from the wastewater treatment plant, for example. It's coming? Okay. Where'd they go? For now, that I want to know is, what is the source? And then later, what is the fate? And what is the transportation?
This summer, Rios Mendoza will be collecting samples from points along the north shore of Minnesota and south shore of Wisconsin to see if microplastics are present. She says they'll begin collecting data from Stewart River and work their way down the North Shore to gather samples from the St. Louis, Nemadji, and Amnacon Rivers, among others. You're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Danielle Kading. Up next, we hear about efforts to pinpoint the origin of invasive mussels in the Apostle Islands on Lake Superior. This summer, the National Park Service is working with researchers from Northland College and the University of Minnesota to find out how zebra and quagga mussels got there. Zebra mussels were first found in the Duluth Superior Harbor in 1989, while quagga mussels arrived in the ballast water of ships in 2005. The aquatic invaders tend to crowd out native freshwater mussels. Julie Van Stappen with the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore says the zebra and quagga mussels were discovered there in recent years.
There was some diving done on the Savona, which is near Sand Island, and they discovered some zebra mussels there. And so that was an alarm. And then shortly thereafter, we found out that the Wisconsin DNR had found some between Michigan and Stockton on the other side of the archipelago. So what we tried to do is figure out where they're coming from. Are they going to spread? What the origin was and all that. So we were able to pull together some National Park Service funding, and we're working with the University of Minnesota, Mike McCartney, on a project in which he's going to take samples and try to determine the genetic origin and also to conduct a risk assessment. And then in conjunction with that, Tobin LaFrancois out of Northland College will be doing a survey for native mussels to look at what kind of other species might be at risk.
Was this a relatively new finding? Have you seen zebra or quagmire?
Very new finding. So the theory was that there's too low of calcium within Lake Superior for zebra mussels to do well. And with increasing temperatures, it's possible that the chemistry is changing. There's others that can speak much better to that than I can. But there has been, on occasion, some a few zebra mussels in Chequamegon Bay, but they don't seem to persist. So one theory, and we don't know for sure if this happened, but it's possible that during those big floods from Duluth, that there may have been some washed over this way, because that's the way the currents go. And there have been zebra mussels in St. Louis River area for quite some time. So we're trying to just kind of stay on top of it, because that would be the likely location there. Now, as far as the quagga mussels, did they come off of boats or nets? We don't know. So we're trying to figure out how much of a problem is this, if there is a problem.
So is this the first time you've seen it in the park then?
It is the first time it's been documented in the park. And actually, the quagga mussels that were found are technically outside the park, but they're within the archipelago area. And the zebra mussels are potentially, right outside that quarter-mile boundary. But if you drew a line around the islands, they're within that.
Okay.
So, the zebra mussels were found on the far western part of the park, and the quagga mussels on the far eastern part of the park.
So why is this important for the park to work with, the University of Minnesota, try and find out what's happening?
Well, the quagga and zebra mussels can cause a lot of problems and a lot of kind of cascading issues. At Sleeping Bear Dunes, they've covered the floor of the lake, the bottom of the lake, and then there is this interaction between the mussels and bacteria to the point where it's causing waterfowl die-offs. Mussels can cause a lot of problems in general, the zebra mussels, from, clogging of pipes. But from an ecological perspective, there's kind of this cascading effect that can actually really affect birds and cause botulism.
Mike McCartney is a research assistant professor with the Minnesota Aquatic Invasive Species Research Center at the University of Minnesota. McCartney is one of the researchers for the study, and he's also a geneticist that works on the genetics of natural populations.
That's actually really important for the possible study, because the kinds of genetics that we use allow us to ask questions about, the mussels that are on the wreck of the Savona or the mussels that are off Madeline Island and Michigan Island. Where did those mussels, where could they have originated? Did they come from somewhere else in Lake Superior? Were they brought here, when you're in a great lake like that, that's the first thing you think of, is they may have come from Duluth. And so we can use these genetic approaches to ask questions about their origins.
First off, I should ask, is it zebra mussels or quagga mussels that you'll be looking at, or both?
It's both. The zebra mussels are on the Savona, so that's not a huge density of them, but it's definitely these wrecks in the lake that are not too far off the shore, like the Thomas Wilson that's off Duluth Superior Harbor. It has zebra mussels on it. So that's a spot for zebra mussels. So that's kind of the way the park people look at it. They say that's the west side of the park. And then on the other side, in between Madeline and Michigan Islands, those are quagga mussels, apparently.
Okay. So there's kind of an east-west divide among the mussels, huh?
Yeah, there is. And that doesn't necessarily mean that they came from different places, because, for example, Duluth has both species. Superior doesn't have a lot of either of them. So I got interested in it because I knew that, and when I heard that there was this new discovery, the old explanation, which is probably reasonable, for why there is not a lot of mussels of either species in Lake Superior, is that the concentration in the lake of calcium is low. It's below 12 milligrams per liter, which is kind of, it's roughly the threshold value for these guys being able to actually grow their shell. They use calcium to make their shell hard. So they mineralize the shell by depositing calcium. And they can't grow, and the little larvae have shells too. So they can't grow as larvae, they can't grow as adults. They basically seem to be kind of fussy about that, particular aspect of the lake chemistry. And so what they seem to be able to do is to make it in these places where rivers are coming in or where there's some sort of land-derived input of that particular, you know, ion. And so, yeah, when I heard about it, I thought, huh, where's that? And then the Savona is, you know, it's a little ways offshore. So that's actually one part of this study is to try to determine, are the calcium concentrations at the level that you would expect these things would need to be able to support a population? And does it vary throughout the year and all that sort of stuff? You know, we're eventually going to try to address that.
But as far as the focus of the overall study, you want to figure out what exactly?
So there's a couple of goals that I'll be involved in. The main goal that I'll be involved in is to use our genetic approaches, and I should say genomic, to use markers that are scattered across the chromosomes of both species. And those markers allow us to ask some questions about the likely population of origin for the mussels that are found in the waters near Bayfield. So, you know, and the reason why that's important is that the park wants to know how they get here, you know, what's the likely scenario that explains their arrival here. Was it is it likely from, you know, recreational boating traffic? Is it likely to have, you know, one of our hypotheses that doesn't include that is one that says that they were born in Duluth Superior Harbor and they were cast out in the lake as offspring and they were carried by currents and by, you know, just by water flow driven by winds down far east of there, and they've settled onto these sites near the Apostles. So that's what we're going to ask, is where they come from. And the other things that are being asked with the study are kind of two things. One is the water chemistry of the area conducive to growth of these mussels? So that'll allow them to forecast the risk that this population is likely to persist and maybe grow. And the final goal of it is to try to start to lay down a baseline for the effect of these mussels, these invasive mussels, on the native animals that are in the park. And what I mean by that is basically the native freshwater mussels, which we know are really vulnerable to basically being choked off by these zebra and quagga mussels. The zebra and quagga mussels settle on the native mussels so thickly that they can actually make it hard for them, the native mussels, to open up and feed or to move, you know, through the sand and to survive. But one of the things we see right away, for example, in inland lakes in Minnesota, is once the zebra mussels arrive, the native mussels disappear.
And how does that affect the entire ecosystem, then, if the native mussels go away?
Well, I think from the standpoint of the Park Service, their first concern is with biodiversity, and a place like the Apostle Islands or the St. Croix River, let's say, that, you know, that they manage, one of the real values of those water bodies, waterways, is that they house a real diversity of these native freshwater mussels, which are native to North America. You know, that it's a remarkable story in natural history that there's all these different species of these mussels, and they certainly serve a role in the larger ecosystem as well. They serve a role which is, you know, I think smaller in magnitude and different from the role that the zebra mussels serve. They also filter the water. They filter out, you know, often it's algae as well, suspended micro, you know, planktonic algae. They also feed in the sand, and they on organic material and whatnot that's down in the sediments of the lake. There's many fewer of them. So the densities are much smaller than the densities of the zebra mussels. So their impact, probably their impact on the food chain is, I would say, is substantially smaller. But they're just really nice animals. You know, they're just the value of the animals themselves is quite high to something like a national lakeshore, you know, or riverway. And we know that one of the things we know really well about zebra mussels is that they come in and they cause these local population declines and local extinctions of the native mussels. So that's bad.
Okay.
Yeah, that has a direct impact on the resources and the value. I mean, a lot of people don't really know about them until they learn about the native mussels, and then they realize how many different kinds there are, how really beautiful they are, you know, how fragile they are. They really are quite fragile. So they're that's another thing you can think of as well. They tend to be a really good indicator of the health of a system, like Lake Superior, you know, or like a really clean river, like the St. Croix. They're a good indicator of a high quality water supply. So we know that because in areas of the country where they've been lost, they get lost because the water quality degrades. So they're really just cool animals, you know. They have a really cool story to tell about their biology. Yeah, so it's a real shame to watch them get basically, you know, eliminated when these invasives come in.
McCartney says they should be able to determine the origin of the mussels within the next year. We're going to take a short break for these announcements, but when we come back, we'll talk about the Northwest Wisconsin Lakes Conference held today and the upcoming Grandma's Marathon this weekend. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you with us on this Friday. Natural resource managers, scientists, and community members gathered in Hayward today for the Northwest Wisconsin Lakes Conference. One of the keynote speakers at the conference was Aaron Thompson. He's an associate professor at UW Stevens Point. He joined me by phone to talk about how communities should examine the norms that exist among their residents so they can understand how that can impact water quality.
You know, within any one of these challenges, and specifically with water, there are a lot of different voices that have a different story to tell about why it's important to them and what they want to see in the future. And then that influences how they respond to some of the challenges that we're facing here in Wisconsin right now. And so the work that I've done largely is within community organizations that are trying to manage these resources, is that I come in and provide kind of the applied social science research. It helps them understand more broadly whether or not their views are shared within their community or, you know, so where the opportunities exist where they have something in common with not just those who live around the resource, but maybe more broadly within the community, why they care about that resource, but also some of the areas where they don't, right, where there isn't an overlap, where there may be disagreement over kind of moving in that direction. And some of what we're trying to do there is clarify some of the goals so that communities can really rally around the things that they agree on in order to move forward on addressing some of these challenges.
What are your recommendations for communities?
So for communities that are trying to engage a broader discussion, engage in a broader discussion about water?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, that's really the key thing here is that it's about building relationships within your community where water is part of that discussion. Especially communities where impaired water is a consideration, there's a tendency to kind of get fixated on just that part of it. But clean water is part of a healthy community. And so how do we broaden this discussion so that we're actually not talking past other people's priorities, but we're actually being inclusive in a way that water becomes the way that we're connected together, whether that be for recreation or, to be honest, for property values for those that live along lakes. They certainly have a stake in that way. But there are also people that enjoy our water just from a standpoint of either supports their business or they just enjoy looking at it, right? It's just the backdrop for their lives.
then what do you see as those barriers that need to be overcome within a community where maybe you have differing viewpoints?
So I think one of the things that really kind of hinders all of these efforts is that we become very single issue focused. We'll get hung up on the problems rather than looking for kind of a common vision that can carry the community forward. And I think that's the biggest challenge that we're all facing, is that some of these conversations get derailed because we start talking about the specifics, when we really need to begin from a place where what we're trying to do is grow the community capacity necessary, which means the relationships between people, right? Build enough trust within our communities that we can actually address some of these challenges head on.
And so what are some of those obstacles then in just building those relationships and trust within the communities? Then, I mean, do you have any examples of people or places you've worked with on that note?
Well, so over in the Lower Fox Basin is probably one of the better examples. I've worked with ag producers over there for the last couple of years. And one of the things that surprised me very early on was that while farmers will get together and talk about a lot of different things, water quality doesn't come up in those conversations. And to be honest, it's not a natural extension of where they're at. And so communities really need some facilitation and some support of, like, how do we begin this dialogue, right? Water may be the backdrop to all of us, right? And we all enjoy, you know, experiencing the setting of our communities through those lakes. But actually sitting down and talking about some of the challenges facing water isn't necessarily a natural thing for communities. And so some kind of structure and support to kind of cling to begin that dialogue, to begin that discussion, is where most communities are at here in Wisconsin, is that they have people that passionately care. So the next step is that they struggle with engaging with the broader community, right? Get past their own single issues and move into a community conversation.
Okay. And so how can they move into that community conversation stage then?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of different ways to go about doing this, and it's going to vary depending on the specifics of each community. And so in some communities, the issue may be that really the conversation is only occurring amongst those who live right around the lake, right? The homeowners that are there that have that direct impact, that direct view of the water. But the reality of it is many people are fishing and swimming and boating on these lakes, and they're not being included in these discussions. And so it's not an easy thing to say, well, excuse me, can I interrupt you so we can talk about water while you're enjoying time with your family on our lake? The challenge is that how do we kind of pull together the types of settings where people, you know, have an opportunity, have the time, and understand the importance of having that conversation?
Again, that was Aaron Thompson with UW Stevens Point talking about the social side of water quality management from the Northwest Wisconsin Lakes Conference today. Well, Grandma's Marathon kicks off early Saturday morning in Duluth, and race organizers say it's going to be a record-setting year as far as the number of runners taking part in their three races this weekend. Grandma's spokeswoman, Kate Kuczynski, spoke with me by phone yesterday about what last-minute details they're getting ready for the races and what lies ahead for Saturday.
So Grandma's Marathon began in 1977. It was just kind of a group of road racers. They were the North Star Striders, and they kind of, started this race. It was kind of one of their training runs, and they had the foresight to kind of decide that, hey, we're going to run this marathon, and they needed a sponsor, so they kind of shopped, like, looked around. It happened that the Grandma's Restaurant Company was opening at the same time, and they bought the title sponsorship, and so we kind of had a name to boot. And then from then, we had about 116 finishers that first year in 1977. So now, fast forward to today, where we have two races now. We have the Gary Bjorklund Half Marathon and Grandma's Marathon, and we have 8,800 registered in the full marathon with 8,900 registered in the half marathon coming up. So, and then we also added the 5K a few years, the 5K celebrating 24 years, and that's the William A. Irvin. And that runs on Friday night of race weekend every year, and we have 2,300. So overall, nearly 19,000 runners are coming, plus their families, to Duluth this weekend. And, you know, so from the small, humble beginnings of 116 to nearly 19,000, really great race for Duluth and for Two Harbors.
You know, what are some of the things that people can expect to see this weekend with the races going on in Duluth?
Yeah, so we actually start with the Thursday, the Essentia Health Fitness Expo, and that kind of kicks off. People start picking up their packets, and, you know, then you can kind of see the final touches here in Canal Park. The tents are already up, and then, you know, now we're putting in guardrails and bridges and things just to make the race weekend flow a little bit smoothly. And then Friday, moving into Friday, we have the expo starting again. We have the Michelina's all-you-can-eat spaghetti dinner. That has been a tradition of Grandma's Marathon since day one. You know, it's a family style. You come and you celebrate and talk stories, and it's for the whole community, and a lot of the community just comes down to meet some of the runners that will be running. This year we have Duluth native Kara Goucher. She's coming back. She's our course record holder, and she's going to be running the Gary Bjorklund Half Marathon, and we're so excited to have her back, especially as a Duluth girl. And then Friday night is the William A. Irvin 5K, and that's just a 5K course. It's a scenic tour of Canal Park. You know, runners get treated to running right along the lake walk and then underneath the aerial lift bridge, which is such an iconic scene in Duluth. And then, you know, then it's kind of we have the Rock the Big Top with Everclear and Vertical Horizon and Fastball coming in. It's a really fun atmosphere for maybe the runners' families. A lot of runners don't go because it is the night before a big race. So it's more for, like, their families and the Duluth community to come out and see a nationally touring act. Saturday morning is very early. It's a very exciting time. You'll see Duluth abuzz with a lot of activity before 4 in the morning even. The Gary Bjorklund Half Marathon is our first marathon. It starts at 6:15 a.m., and that starts right on the second leg of Grandma's Marathon, so right in between Duluth and Two Harbors. And, you know, that is one of our really popular races, of course, and runners have been training. It's a great race for those maybe just getting into running and they want to run a longer distance but aren't quite ready to take on that full 26.2 miles. And, you know, as they kind of traverse down the course, they're treated to these beautiful lake views, a sunrise. And so it's just a really great course. It's very flat. The volunteers are second to none. And then starting at 7:45 a.m. in Two Harbors, we actually have the 41st Annual Grandma's Marathon kicking off. And, you know, those runners have been training for months. This is like the culmination of all of that hard work and training. And we're, you know, so excited. It finishes right in the heart of Canal Park. And the atmosphere is really amazing. A lot of those runners, you can see it on their faces as they cross the finish line, how wonderful they're feeling. And after that, it's just a celebration in Canal Park. You know, we have a runner's recovery area complete with free massages for them, get their gear bag, they get a couple drinks, then they can go into the Big Top Entertainment and really enjoy the weekend and celebrate. Because, you know, coming to Duluth for Grandma's Marathon is about coming for the race, but come and stay for the party and also come and explore the North Shore. This is, you know, we really get to see a lot of people that maybe haven't been to Duluth or the North Shore before. And so it's a really great place for them to just see and Duluth's shining moment.
Well, and I was just going to ask you, too, like, what is it about Grandma's Marathon that brings Olympic athletes and beginners alike to this race?
Yeah, so we, you know, we've had some world-class athletes come finish our course. Meb is one of our course record holders, and Kara Goucher, and we actually have our returning champion. He's been coming back, Alicia Barnot. And, you know, for them, it's just it's a great reunion. They come back each year, and they say, this is just the great course to race. The city really embraces the sporting event. And then for citizen runners, it's just a really great course for them to start on. We offer such great aid along the whole course. Our volunteers are the best, we would say, in marathons around the country. We have over 6,000 volunteers on race day alone. For a community of 86,000, just to be able to support this marathon, it's really great.
Wow. Yeah, that's a lot of people. That's like one-third of the people running.
Yeah, so we even have people that just, our volunteer coordinator sits very near me in the office, and people come up and drive because they just want to volunteer, and they want to be a part of it, and that's so special for us. And, you know, the fun, we also have people that just will put out their own, they kind of do it on their own. We offer course entertainment even along the course, so we kind of encourage people to bring their banjo or, you know, do their dance routine. There's a lot of cheerleaders along the course. We even have a few bands, community bands that play, and just really getting those runners, get them through those 26.2 miles. It's one of the reasons, like, you know, our runners come back and they say, your volunteers were great, the course entertainment was great, the views were amazing. And so it's really a testament to us. We Grandma's Marathon actually is the 11th largest marathon in the country, and if you and it's the one of the few that are in a non-major metropolitan area. So if you look at, you know, the top ones, there's Boston, New York, Marine Corps. They're all in large cities. And then you see Duluth, Minnesota coming in at number 11. And it's just really a testament to this city and the community support we get every year.
Well, I hope it all goes well for you this weekend. Anything else that you want to add, Kate?
No, I think that's great. We're just... So if you've never considered Grandma's Marathon before, it's not just for grandmas.
It's for
everyone,
everyone
alike.
And you can eat grandmas afterwards if you feel
like
it.
Yeah, we do have a grandma. We have a mascot, kind of. She's at the finish line welcoming every single runner, and so she's so great, and we're so lucky to have her come back every single year.
Well, thanks so much, Kate. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk about what's happening this weekend.
Yeah, thanks for calling in.
Again, you were just listening to Kate Kuczynski with Grandma's Marathon. Again, the half marathon begins at 6:15 tomorrow morning close to the Clearwater Grill, and the full marathon begins at 7:45 a.m. at the starting line in Two Harbors. And that's it for our program. You can hear it again online on our website at wpr.org/Superior. You can also check us out on our Facebook page at facebook.com/KUWSFM. You've been listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Danielle Kading. We hope to have you back with us next Friday. Until then, have a great rest of your weekend.